Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Masonic Hope Companion. I'm your host, Dale Graham. It's a pleasure to see you all back. Thank you very much. And it's a wonderful day here in Southern Ontario, the 160th day of the year, 9th of June, 2013. And we're getting close, of course. Keep in mind the upcoming solstice. That's happening on the 21st of June at 5:04. I expect to see all of our Masonic friends out there with whatever necessaries they have in hand at that time of the morning, praising the benefits of the longest day and also the shortest night. This is I think we have an interesting program coming up. This program we entitled the Commission of Freemasonry, as in, you know, the act of Freemasonry. We're in curious times always, and there's so many questions that I have, and I always need your help in trying to pull together the ideas and at least have some sense of rationality instead of walking around. If we're comfortable following up on myths, and that's our area of study, then absolutely wonderful. We can see analogy in all types of mythical creatures, and I have no issue with that. But to pretend, you know, if we cross the line and our myths begin to be taken literally, that's not so good. And I don't think anybody, may have a tendency to drift that way, particularly about these very specious kind of historical connections that are just sort of woven into the fabric of a lot of Masonic discussions. Life goes on and it doesn't seem to wait. Progress doesn't seem to wait for any one of us. This week, for those of you who are so inclined to like their diet without anything with eyes, vegetarians and vegans, and there are more of us out there that are making that active decision because of health reasons, and the environment, we're told, is not going to be able to support the kind of lifestyle that we've grown up on, and that comes as no support. We come and go, our particular lifestyle comes and goes. Not to be bleak about it, but, you know, it's the seasons of life. But something called schmeat is going to be grilled up. Schmeat is a protein, a meat type protein material that's being grown in labs. And for the past about 2.5 years at Maastricht University, a physiologist named Mark Post has been working on this. They put in a fair amount of money, about 350,000 pounds, something like that, in this research. Well, they have enough of this material that they're going to grill a whole patty, like a hamburger, a whole patty of this. That's going to happen in London, and I can imagine it'll be eaten. But I guess I can get used to just about anything these days. But the next generations coming along probably won't notice it as much. I'm the kind of person that still, you know, recalls when the milkman delivered the a jug of milk and it had the cream on the top of it. that, you know, the if such a thing as 1% and 2% were things that we were being taught in, you know, grade 4 or grade 3 class, not over a milk carton. And there wasn't a great deal of concern about lost children, and you could get ice delivered from a wagon, hot horse-drawn wagon. I'd like to say that wasn't that long ago. Probably was. I don't think that was necessarily better or best. It was what it was, just like today. The things around us will seem old-fashioned to our children. And yet for us, you know, to go around thinking that this is all that weird and wonderful world, it's always been changing, and you and I just need to be able to pay attention to that fact. And we've been changing. That six-pack has now turned into a 2-4. And for some of us, it may have slipped a little further south than the equator. So if that's not to the effect of gravity, what is? So at least we're in good company. And did you know? I want to give you a few did you know kind of things about masonry. And we're going to talk a bit. I've got a little bit of here on from Tobias Church, and that scholar from Freemasonry, from his book The Reality. I am going to also go over more of the abstracts from the recent international conference in the history of Freemasonry in Edinburgh, because the show was cut. You know, we just ran out of time last week. And I'm sitting here again, going to do small tastes again. Remember, I talked to you about trying the effect of Albert Pike on the digestive tract, material that should only be taken in small bits and bites. And so we're going to try a very, very small sliver of material from Morals and Dogma. And sitting next to that, of course, is Wilmshurst's material on the meaning of Freemasonry. Interesting, though, just to give us some context, I think that's a reasonable and worthwhile thing to do. I'll start off here with a little bit of the history on the 9th of June. Did you know this is kind of a sad day for the relatives of the Roman Emperor Nero in the year 68. He committed suicide. Apparently, he got himself in a wee bit of trouble with the Senate. No, that's too much of too tempting to talk about things senatorial today, particularly as a Canadian. So we'll just let that one slide where it belongs. But he was, Senate imposed death by flogging on the boy. You know, couldn't take a joke, I guess. And they made me cross the line a lot. Anyway, he implored his secretary to slit his throat. You know, I guess it comes with a job. So the year 68, I'm glad we moved on from that. Good grief. Odo of Aquitaine defeated the Moors in the Battle of Toulouse. That was in 721. Some of you probably were there, and if you've had those out-of-body life experiences, I'm sure. In 1456, it was the 23rd recorded perihelion passage of Halley's Comet. That was 1456. People are paying attention. Eh? And 1534, Jacques Cartier first sailed into the mouth of the St. Lawrence. Thank goodness we see these references have removed the silliness of discovery, the stuff that was being peddled when I was a schoolboy, that anything European was a matter of discovery and everything else was a matter of this, paganism and senseless open land here in North America. Thank goodness we're starting to realize that was how inaccurate that was. Anyway, and this year in 1549, the Book of Common Prayer was adopted by the Church of England. And you know, we won't get into the history of that fascinating history leading up to all of that, and particularly for the Prespers and for Henry, the king. Sweden and Denmark were making nice, and they signed the Third Treaty of Stockholm. That was about time, some of us might say. And that was 1720, and the royal charter for Georgia was granted to James Oglethorpe. There you go. There were went through various battles of French surrendering to the English in Trichinopoly, India. Everybody was battling on somebody else's neighborhood. The first Protestant church went up in Penn, Ohio, and it held the communion on this date in 1772. And this was the first naval attack of Revolutionary War off Providence, Rhode Island. So we had, then we skip ahead just a little bit here. The U.S. Academy at West Point, if anybody cares, was founded on this date in 1802. And if you're one of my ancestors, Charles Graham, patented false teeth on this date in 1822. Doesn't matter to me now, but I'm sure for a lot of people it does. But on this date in 1869, Charles Elmer Hires sold his very first root beer in Philadelphia. Always liked that when I was a kid. Just couldn't handle it today, I guess. The opera Robin Hood premiered in Chicago on this date in 1890, for those of you who haven't had a look at that. And in 1901, the New York Giants recorded 31 hits to beat the Cincinnati Reds 25-13. Can you imagine 31 hits? On this date in 1909, Alice Hullier Ramsey, 22-year-old housewife and mother from Hackensack, New Jersey, became the first woman to drive across the United States with three female companions, none of whom could drive a car. In 59 days, she drove a Maxwell automobile the 3,800 miles from Manhattan to San Francisco. And on this date in 1914, Honus Wagner was second to get 3,000 hits. I'm guessing, I'm looking at American research. It seems a little bit narrow, like big whoop, hey? And then the first Donald Duck cartoon, Wise Little Hen, was released this date in 1934. He had already been out since 1931, but let me skip ahead a little bit to skip through the war, not because it's unimportant, it's just not here. Another day, another discussion. The Eddie R. Carroll was aboard Hoop Jr., and he won the 71st Kentucky Derby in a time of 2:07. That was in 1945. And it comes to mind because the Belmont Stakes went off yesterday, the end of the Triple Crown, that long one on turf. And this was the, on 1955, 100 degrees Fahrenheit, the hottest day ever recorded in Seattle, Washington. That was pretty big news if you were in Washington at the time. And the rest, you know, tragedies and accidents don't exactly seem like news. But there you have it. That's a little bit about the world and history. These dates, little bit of Masonic history here around this date. This is the 9th, and it was on this date in 1849 that the Prince Hall Grand Lodge of Delaware was established. And just a couple of days from now, in 1986, the United Grand Lodge of England required the removal of references to the physical penalties from all its obligations. Progress. And on June 13th, in 1889, or maybe it was the 12th, they're not really sure, the Grand Lodge of North Dakota was organized. So we're coming up, let's see, this is the 12th, so the 20th of June in 1812, the Grand Lodge of Louisiana was formed. And in 1881, on the 20th, Albert Mackey, the Secretary General of the Supreme Council of the Scottish Rite Southern Jurisdiction, interesting fellow, history is just bubbling to the surface. He passed away this date. And on June 23rd in 1780, Wolfgang Goethe, the philosopher, was initiated in Amalia Lodge in Weimar. I won't get into, there's so much going on the 24th of June. We'll talk about that next week. It's, you know, 1717, 1731, all that kind of stuff. Benjamin Franklin became Grand Master. But, you know, it separates out. I want you to think realistically. We have this fascination with provenance in Freemasonry that is hard to deny. Oldest first. Always oldest first. Oldest first is better. And we should be respectful of oldest first. When we want to lay claim, I think to legitimize in some way, I believe is the reason, sort of an authenticity of the importance or significance of Freemasonry, we'll often cite, you know, the membership of fairly famous people. But I want to ask you a question. A lot of the famous people that are associated with the order went through an initiation. And some, if you look at it, I'm not going to mention any names right here, right now, but some of these people didn't attend more than that one meeting. Now, I need to ask you, how much influence did the order have on that person? I'm saying very little. They were probably good people, notable, but the kind of people that we would like to think are suitable or monuments, credits, let's say, to the principles of Freemasonry. But if you were asking, does Freemasonry, you know, do I think there was a great in-depth connection between that type of celebrity and the principles of Freemasonry or the philosophy? I'd have to say it seems doubtful to me based on the evidence. So I know I would be challenged by angry authoritative Masons to say, of course, that's wrong of me to question out loud. But realistically and frankly, these folks had other things in their mind. I tend to think perhaps that being part of Masonic order gave them a level of authenticity that they otherwise could not achieve on their own. As still is the case today. And I think the caution that we need to be aware is that it's easy to become self-serving. Self-serving, that we're convincing ourselves, we're talking ourselves into something that we keep saying it over and over again as if we need to encourage the belief rather than describing things with critical and objective thought. Such is the nature of our quest to become more involved or to have a closer relationship with academics. I think is a brilliant segue to allow me to talk more about the abstracts from the International Conference on the History of Freemasonry. I did get some good feedback on the from last week, so that was more than a little encouraging. You seem to find that useful. So here, this was getting into the end of the in the afternoon of the work. There was a paper delivered on the Masonic Internationals from the end of 19th century to the dawn of Second World War and the Belgian leading role. Interesting country, Belgium, eh? The end of 19th century in Europe was characterized by the birth of political internationals. At the same movement, several Masonic and Freethinkers national associations created altogether international associations in the perspective to coordinate their activities. These international associations were the International Bureau of Masonic Relationships, the International Masonic Association, and International Federation of Freethinkers. The International Bureau of Masonic Relationships is the first international Masonic association. It was created in the International Masonic Congress held in Geneva in September 1902 in order to establish relations between the various Masonic powers of the globe outside of all obedience and all rituals to support mutual research for scientific, philosophical, and sociological truth. Its headquarter was in Geneva, but the Belgian Freemasonry has contributed greatly to its foundation. Its activity has stopped because of the First World War. The International Bureau of Masonic Relations is followed by the International Masonic Association, still based in Geneva, and credited at the first Masonic International Congress in post-war, and created, sorry. Its headquarters is still in Switzerland, as well as the Chancellery, while for several years its chairmen were Belgians. The aim of this association is to intensify the results of humanitarian and peaceful propaganda of every national Freemasonry. Interesting wording, isn't it? Very precise. The International Federation of Freethinkers was created at the International Conference held in Brussels in 1880. The permanent office was established in Brussels and chaired by the Belgians. The purpose of this association was to achieve a peaceful and egalitarian society in opposition to that envisaged by the Catholics. There you go. As I underlined, when you listen to Belgian scholars, I know I'll be terribly pithy about this, but to generalize, I find them very objective, very secular in their outlook. They're able to just sort of pick up and the idea of religions and commitments and faiths and examine it so almost uncomfortably. But very, very, with an eye of reason. And so I'm just saying that in reaction to this, that the purpose of the association was to achieve a peaceful and egalitarian society in opposition to that envisaged by the Catholics, who I presume we may be talking about Catholicism as if, you know, that zeal to spread this particular faith, that missionary sense, in the sense perhaps of intrusion, of ignoring the indigent populations and their spirituality. As I underlined, the Belgian Freemasons and Freethinkers were among the creators of these worldwide associations. In fact, it is in the Belgian Masonic archives that it is possible to consult the documentation in order to trace the history of these associations, which organized an impressive number of meetings all around Europe for almost half a century. And that was a paper brilliantly presented by Nicoletta Cassano of Belgium. Fascinating bit of work. She was a PhD candidate, or is. The next paper was by Niles Wines Morse of Australia, The Mason on the $50 Note, Co-Masonry in 20th Century Australia. Edith Cowan was the first woman member of an Australian parliament. Her contribution to Australian society, particularly through her championing of women's issues, is acknowledged through the naming of a university after her, and her image is depicted on Australia's $50 banknote. Edith Cowan was also a founder member of the Co-Masonic Order in Western Australia. Although Co-Masonry has been operated in Australia for more than a century, there has been a dearth of research into the Order's history and its place in the Australian social framework. The paper outlined its history based on records in the Order's own archives and documented some of the principal characters, such as Edith Cowan, in its foundation, early development, and ongoing existence. These stages in the Order's history, together with the perception of the Order by the wider population, was considered in light of reports published in the press in Australia. Morris also looked at the effects on the Order by high-profile co-Masonic visitors to Canada, such as Mrs. Bessant, and the resultant press reactions. That's Mrs. Bessant, B-E-S-A-N-T, influential in co-Masonry, and it's a name unfamiliar to me. A secondary thread will be the relationship of the co-Masonic Order with the male craft, as seen through the prisms of both popular press and the specialized Masonic press. The relationship between the Co-Masonic Order, the Liberal Catholic Church, and the Theosophical Society in Australia was explored through Australian Co-Masonic records. Co-Masonic Archives in the United States, and by use of the John Cooper Theosophy Collection held at the National Library of Australia. So if you weren't there, you don't get to be part of the discussion. Sorry about that. Susan Mitchell Summers' charity a session on a prehistoric lodge in Rhode Island, Masonry and the Messianic Movement. This is published in this is a paper presented by work by Samuel Biagetti for the United States, and he's referring to a paper published in 1853 by Edward Peterson's History of Rhode Island, describing the arrival of the first Jewish settlers in colonial Newport in 1658, and puts forward the extraordinary claim that these colonists brought with them the degrees of Masonry. This assertion flies in the face of the accepted history of Masonry in America, which begins with the formation of colonial lodges in the 1730s. The notion has usually been summarily dismissed by Masonic critics. However, an examination of the sources for Peterson's claim reveals that it is, in fact, quite plausible. So we're talking about the difference between 1730, sort of the official, if you want to say, I know that's a scary thing to say about any history, but 1730 and this earlier report indicating 1658. The Newport Jewish colonists reportedly founded a circuitous route from the Netherlands to Brazil, the West Indies, and finally Rhode Island, which in fact traces the networks of trade and migration uniting Jews, Quakers, and other religious dissenters in the tumultuous 17th century Atlantic. Moreover, these Jews could easily have been introduced to Freemasonry in the Netherlands, where a number of Scottish Masons built strong relationships with Dutch diplomats and intellectuals, and likely initiated some of them in the Masonic mysteries. Indeed, 18th century sources also plausibly claim the Dutch rabbi Jacob Jehuda Leon as a Freemason. The sum of circumstantial evidence suggests that Peterson's identification of the early Newport Jews as Freemasons is based on fact. More importantly, a re-examination of the Newport episode reveals the dense network of Jewish-Christian exchange in the 17th century that gave shape to Freemasonry and its belief system. As religious wars tore through Europe, Jews and Christians alike turned to millennial and messianic thought, as embedded in Kabbalah and other mystical traditions, as a source of hope. This messianic network seized on Solomon's temple as a unifying symbol of ancient knowledge, which must be recovered in preparation for the millennium. Jacob Jehuda Leon was famous for building a detailed model of the temple, which was displayed in Amsterdam and London. Isaac Abreu de Fonseca, the leader of the Jewish community in Brazil, was also an avid Kabbalist and Messianist. In sum, the arrival of a small group of Jewish Masons in Newport demonstrates the complexity of religious ferment in the 17th century, which helped to shape life on both sides of the Atlantic and to infuse profound religious meaning into Freemasonry. Religious meaning without being a religion. Interesting, huh? So, if this should pretty much dispel any of these notions about Freemasonry being a Christian order. However, the ludicrous awareness, a paper by Amy E. Newell, PhD, of the United States came up next, A Ludicrous Affair, Harmonic Lodge and Boston Freemasonry in the 1790s. This was a fascinating bit of work. In 1795, members of Boston's Harmonic Lodge caused quite a stir. After a rowdy meeting one night, two brothers met on the dueling field. The Grand Lodge of Massachusetts caught wind of the affair and suspended the lodge's charter, later revoking it in 1797. Events so dramatic as these were uncommon in Boston lodges, but by 1798, Boston Freemasonry arrived at a crossroads. Some members advocated growth, while others urged a moratorium on new lodges. This question involved precedent-setting direct decisions about where lodges would be established and who would become members. The story of Harmonic Lodge, which received its charter in 1791, serves as a valuable case study through which to explore substantive issues related to Boston Freemasonry during the 1790s. Harmonic Lodge's founding and brief tumultuous existence took place as Americans struggled to forge a new national identity. In turn, the Grand Lodge of Massachusetts, which overcame decades of disagreement and united the city's ancient and modern Grand Lodges in 1792, worked to establish its authority and define itself during these years. The Grand Lodge published a new Book of Constitutions and made determinations about how it would approach Masonic ritual, local charity, and internal structure. The Grand Lodge of Massachusetts, the third oldest Grand Lodge in the world, rested on the precipice of the unknown in 1792. No one knew what would happen. Would it flourish or flounder? The story of Harmonic Lodge provides insight into how the city's leading Freemasons, including Paul Revere, Josiah Bartlett, and John Warren, viewed the fraternity and its future. By examining Masonic and non-Masonic sources, such as the personal letters and diaries of members of the Grand Lodge and Harmonic Lodge, Grand Lodge proceedings, newspapers, and other published reports, this paper added understanding not just to the history of Boston Freemasonry, but how Freemasonry adapted itself to a new nation. Fascinating. But I think that, personally, that was eclipsed by this next bit of work by Hillary Anderson Stelling, also an American researcher, called Elucidating the Various Masonic Emblems, the Influence of Jeremy Cross and Amos Doolittle's Engravings on 19th Century American Masonic Material and Visual Culture. Between 1825 and 1838, Martha Harding drew an image titled The 40th Page of the Masonic Chart, in a mark book kept by her father's Royal Arch Chapter in Massachusetts. In 1861, a Pennsylvania craftsman carefully inked over 70 images of Masonic symbols and scenes onto the surface of a wooden cash box. From 1866 to 1872, a California carpenter, Eric Albertson, carved a sculpture of a weeping virgin, Father Time, and a broken column to ornament the top of a new Masonic temple. Although these artists crafted each of these objects years apart at diverse locations and for different purposes, their work shares an inspiration. The engravings that Amos Doolittle and Jeremy Cross prepared. Amos was working, he was alive between 1754 and 1832, and Cross came along later, 1783 to 1860. So that's what they mean by different times. The true Masonic chart or hieroglyphic monitor came along a little later. The 42 engraved plates that Cross designed with Doolittle had a profound and long-lasting influence on Masonic visual and material culture created by American folk artists from the 1820s through the 1870s. Cross's The True Masonic Chart, initially published in 1819, was not the first Masonic handbook designed for an American audience, nor was it the earliest to include a chart of Masonic emblems. But Cross gave his readers something new, multiple illustrations of scenes, symbols, and lodge furnishings to help them better understand Masonic ritual and symbols. As well, Cross worked hard marketing his book. An itinerant Masonic lecturer, Cross traveled extensively and used his considerable connections in the fraternity to sell his publication throughout the United States. He printed over 15 editions of the True Masonic Chart. Now, that said, is it becoming apparent to you that I'm continuously referencing European and American scholarship? And it's rather difficult for me as a Canadian Mason, as a Mason here in the Grand Lodge of Canada, to feel that there is a relevant history of Masonry in Canada that could be of interest and could add to the understanding of the evolution and development of Freemasonry. But it's not happening. I'll sweep aside any sense of argument about this and simply say I think it's overdue. I really do. I think it's overdue, and I think that since we have we are stakeholders in this kind of research, and we do not have the ability to be critical and objective in a room with each other. We do need the work of academics, just as what we're hearing here. Each of the speakers is screened. And this is an academic event, not a Masonic event. And I think that needs to be kept clear. The integrity of research in universities, particularly in Ontario, has been challenged lately. Some of you perhaps have heard about some very large telecommunications companies offering money to fund research chairs, but wanting to be able to control the nature of the research being done. And there's also discussions, and it's not unknown for people to be funding research chairs to want to have first right to the research results. Now, of course, this is an interference, we could say that some type of dealing goes on in any kind of academic environment. Well, yeah, there's some type of dealing, whether it's underhanded or whether it undermines the objectivity and independence of the scholars is another question. So it's not just in fact, not just what we sign on a contract, but the appearance of objectivity that needs to be maintained. These people come forward with that capacity. So I think it's overdue that Canada and this part of North America have this discussion, have the benefit of research that is critical, not criticizing, but looking at the evolution and effect, the development of Freemasonry and its history critically. We all benefit. At the end of the day, we all benefit from this. Our old history, old and inaccurate history, is replaced by material that has a precision. We know things today that we didn't know 25 years ago. Are we really saying that we dig our heels in because we were taught something that was in error, and that's all that we can absorb? I'm not ready to cash in my credibility on something like that. That's why whenever I hear anything to do with an official history, it makes me sort of wonder what in the world, how in the world could that be that we can have a so-called official history? History is what it is. It's like, do we have official air, official light? No more do we have an official history or an author. You know, perhaps I like the abridged version. Perhaps I like to study and understand the most accurate history. Maybe that's the most important of all, not to sort of delude myself with something because I was told it was in an official sense. This gets into different kinds of discussions I'll come around to later about whether we're imitators or innovators, whether you are the alchemists so that you claim to be, or are you the soft robots? Are we soft robots? Anyway, do we go through things in rote fashion? Yes, I am. Yes, do we do that kind of thing? Or are we reasoning our way through the work? And not a comfortable question. Not a comfortable question, but an important question. So next to the chair was, you know about the curator of the Museum of Masonry at the Grand Lodge of Scotland. His name is Robert Cooper. A very, very interesting fellow, very studied academic. He chaired a paper by John Wade of the United Kingdom, Freemasons and Radical Political Movements in Edinburgh in the last two decades of that 18th century. And this was a paper that examined radical political movements involving Freemasons during the last two decades. The topic stemmed from earlier research into the unusual Edinburgh Lodge, Roman Eagle number, CLX, 190. While Dr. John Brown, its founding master and the inventor of the Brunonian system of medicine, was seen as radical and revolutionary himself by other scholars. Such as Thomas Beddoes and Erasmus Darwin. Some of his students most definitely belonged to radical political groups. Outstanding among these were Thomas Addis Emmet, an Irishman who was one of the founders of the Lodge Roman Eagle. Having taken his MD in Edinburgh in 1787, by soon after 1790, he had taken up a career in law on the advice of another radical and former Edinburgh medical student, Sir James McIntosh, and became the legal advisor of the Society of United Irishmen. His younger brother, Robert Emmet, was executed as leader of the Irish Rebellion in 1803, and he was only 23. Another Lodge Roman Eagle initiate in 1789 was the radical Edinburgh bookseller John Elder, who was almost certainly a member of the Friends of the People. This prompted a comparison of the membership lists of lodges in Edinburgh and the lists of known Scottish political radicals. It is clear that there was some relationship between the number of Freemasons and some of the radical groups, as evidenced by the 1793 Scottish Martyrs. The Scottish Martyrs held a meeting in Edinburgh Masonic Lodge Room and later being represented in the ensuing trial, which led to their transportation by lawyers who were Masons. The principal questions to be examined are: who were the radical Freemasons active in Edinburgh? What did they join? Where did they meet? And what did they do? Why did they do it? A wider question, bearing in mind events in America and France during the 1770s and 1780s, is why radicals across a grand part of the globe felt comfortable with their membership of Freemasonry. Why radicals across a large part of the globe felt comfortable with their membership of Freemasonry? Seems to run contrary, doesn't it? For given the oaths of Freemasonry. And so it would make us want to go back and examine what ritual and what obligations and oaths were in existence during this period. Pardon me. Next, we take a look at, as if that's not granular enough, we take a look at a paper by Ian McIntosh, also of the United Kingdom, the 1745 Jacobite Uprising and the involvement of East of Scotland Masons in the lodges. Ian covered the involvement of various individual Freemasons who took part in the 1745 uprising, particularly those in the mainly Episcopalian east of Scotland, from the River Tay to the Moray Firth. The important contribution of these Episcopalian landowning and aristocratic men gave to the Stuart cause, and who formed battalions, regiments, and companies to fight on the Jacobite side. Some of these leaders were Freemasons, like the Duke of Perth, Sir John Wedderburn of Blackness, Lord Fitzlagle, Sir Alexander Bannerman of Elsick, and other local men not so famous, like John Cumming, an excise officer in Montrose, who was, Montrose is also one of the bases for the Graham clan, in case you happen to be in that part of Scotland. Say hi to my gene pool. He was an excise officer, was Cumming, who was master of one of the Montrose lodges. And on the one hand, he was courting and welcoming army officers from the French-Irish Brigade into the lodge, and on the other hand, was cooperating with the captain of a Royal Navy ship and was made the government governor of Montrose, someone who seems to be playing both sides. Cumming, answer for yourself there, my friend. Also, Patrick Wallace, merchant and member of the Abroth Lodge, who ended up in the Tower of London. This also fits in others. There are others who took part in the Jacobite side, like John Murray of Broughton, a member of Lodge Canongate Kilwinning, claiming a very, very, very old lodge with wonderful members. If you have a chance to meet any of these fellows, just beautiful Masons, very engaging, serious-minded fellows. Ian also covered the situation regarding individual lodges in Dundee, Arbroath, Montrose, Aberdeen, and Inverness, and the evidence of these at the times contained in the various minute books of these lodges on how the uprising impacted on these lodges, how the other Montrose Lodge was actually initiating French-Irish Brigade officers into the lodge, and the situation of one Inverness Lodge, both during the uprising and the effects of the aftermath of Culloden. Sad day at Culloden. Huh? It took the whole event took on a... Let me close that one off. My daughter's just explaining that we have Wheels and Wings event going on at the Owen Sound Airport. 400 old ancient cars and ancient vintage planes. So if you happen to be out, this is a Sunday, with $8 in your hand. So thank you for... I might as well explain what's going on. Maybe I should shut that puppy off, eh? Yeah, okay. There you go. This whole thing went, it took, added an, a whole other dimension when Dr. David John McLean took on the topic of piping, dress, and song, cultural differences in Scottish Freemasonry from the earliest 18th century to the present day. So you can see that you know, it's not like exhausting any one part of your brain. It's like giving one part a very, very thorough workout and then moving on. And it was like catch up, catch your breath and catch up. So this next paper by McLean was on the early Grand Lodge of Scotland about making a conscious attempt to mirror the style and practices of the more established Grand Lodge of England. This included details such as the size and shape of aprons, as well as the music used in ritual and harmony. Needless to say, this disgruntled many Freemasons in Scotland, who then deliberately adopted many aspects typical of Scottish culture and incorporated them into their Freemasonry. I think the Scots have a term for this kind of an effort, trying to get them to, this is an early attempt to for consistency. It has to make us all smile. It's after the fact here. This paper summarized the development of the Scottish Highland bagpipe from the early 18th century to present day and how this was influenced by Freemasonry. Similarly, it looked at the influence pipe music had on Masonic ceremony and ritual with a more detailed look at the unique traditions of particular lodges, pipe tunes with a Masonic connection, and the establishment of a Grand Lodge piper. The use of the Lowland Scots and Gaelic languages in Freemasonry was also examined along with the use of tartan and other items of Masonic dress peculiar to Scotland. Peculiar to Scotland and a bit of Canada, and a bit of East Coast, and a bit of okay. The influence of the Scottish regiments of the British Army were studied, as well as the impact of institutions such as the Church of Scotland. The paper concluded with a consideration of Robbie Burns and his impact on Masonic culture in Scotland. Whew. So, catch up, take a deep breath, and move on. Here was a session, Freemasonry and National Identities. And this was chaired by a very, very lovely Freemason, James Daniel, and a very forthright man. Yeah. Clear speaker, well schooled. The first paper was by an Armenian, Kachatur Sepanian, and it was on the Lodge of Armenian Masons in Istanbul. And he explained that the national thought of 19th century, he says it this way, an important part of Armenian national thought of 60s, of 19th century, are the activities of dwelling, and he, as he puts in parentheses, love of Armenian Masons. It is known that the second half of 19th century condition of Armenians became worse at the Ottoman Empire. Dimensions of Armenian national constitutional movement was conditioned by the at the Ottoman Empire, the result of which was an establishment of Armenian constitutions at 1860. And that was about Armenians dwelling at the Ottoman Empire. The latter, in fact, was to define national rights of Armenians at the Ottoman Empire. But the national constitution was a frustration for Western Armenians. From one hand, it made no vital changes in the lives of Western Armenians, and from the other hand, it weakened spirit of struggle toward despotism. It was during this time that Western Armenians, especially many eminent representatives of intelligentsia living at Pauls, affiliated universal ethical philosophical streams. Absence of national unity is one of the main reasons of tragedies of Western Armenians. They tried to justify and strengthen the idea of national unity by ideas of universal brotherhood and universal solidarity. Dwelling, love of Armenian Freemasons acting as polis, in fact, noticing a collapse of public values, tried to strengthen by the ideas of above-mentioned universal solidarity and universal brotherhood of perishing Armenian nation. I get the feeling that maybe this translation into English it was a little bit rough. So they conclude, by about a quarter of a century, dwelling love struggled to bring Armenian public life to solidarity at Cape Holes, alleviate growing values, strengthen idea of tolerance among the nation. So we're talking about the impact of the values of Freemasonry on the lodge of Armenian Masons in Istanbul. Brilliant. So the next paper was the story of Bahraini Masonry, and this is by Michael Heron of Britain. It was based on a number of oral histories detailing the evolution of Masonic practice in the Emirate of Bahrain, an island located within the Gulf just off the east coast of Arabia. It was on the latter part of the 1940s that, firstly, members of a number of recognized constitutions formed a square and compasses club, and secondly, a lodge of instruction. The Scottish constitution would be the first constitution that opened the first Masonic lodge in a room within the main RAF aerodrome. The discovery of oil meant the Emirates' industrial and commercial developments needed a growing number of expatriates to work here, resulting in an increase in the number of Scottish lodges that were originally part of the now-defunct District Grand Lodge of Persia. Besides the Scots, the English constitution also opened lodges which were part of the now-defunct District Grand Lodge of Iraq. The formation of an English constitution royal arch chapter and an unattached Mark Lodge opened by the Grand Lodge of Mark Master Masons was also discussed. The untimely and enforced closure of the English Constitution District Grand Lodge of Iraq was considered for its impact on the remaining lodges of Bahrain, resulting in the formation of the District Grand Lodge of the Arabian Gulf. This development and the subsequent closure, barely a year later after its formation of this new district, was discussed as it had caused the remaining English Constitution lodges to be administered directly from Freemasons Hall in London. The events that led up to the decision by the Bahraini government to enforce closure of all the remaining lodges and chapters of all constitutions was discussed. Yep. This would result in legislation being introduced by the Bahraini government proscribing any further Masonic practice. Now, the next session was under the heading Exploring Contemporary Freemasonry. And this is where a contact, an acquaintance of mine, Scott Kenny, Professor Scott Kenny from Memorial University in St. John, Newfoundland, was speaking about paths to Freemasonry today, social factors behind joining the craft between among 20th and 21st century Canadian Freemasons. Now, Scott is just a professor of sociology, but fascinating fellow. I would think if you get a chance to read any of his abstracts, Google him. He has a book coming out that I think you'll find more than a little interesting, and his work is just I found profound. Isn't that You know, he was able to track things using social indicators that bring candidates to the door, which you would think that Freemasonry would have been able to do. I sort of take a lot of this for granted because I did a degree in sociology, so I keep wondering why organizations don't use available data, because it's very descriptive. He refers to a significant membership decline since the 60s. And some areas, he notes that some areas have seen a growth in initiations in the early 21st century, the growth, particularly growth in the Scottish Rite and Southern jurisdiction. And he cites six elements common in the social backgrounds of people joining: predisposing factors, evolving a dramaturgical social interplay, organized encounters, attractive and attracting aspects, and having limited exposure to unattractive factors, and engaging in membership. So longstanding personal connections. So you want to know the significance. Longstanding personal connections with Masons, particularly with family members, does make a difference. Existing personal traits and interests that are congruent with Masonic values, so are influential. So our honesty, the candor, the fraternalism, the what here on Masonic Home Companion we call being the bigger man, having our ego in check. You know, canard for Masons who have been able to look at the three degrees as more than just this, this corporal, physical interpretation. It also, at a metaphysical level, has to do with death of ego, blah blah blah. You know all about that. We've talked about that before on the show. So we can talk about it again. So here from the official program, we hear this was chaired by Andrew Prescott, and who again I consider one of the foremost Masonic scholars, and me not alone. Masonry's profile has grown in recent years, thrust into awareness through popular books, films, websites, and television documentaries. In academia, this has been paralleled by a proliferation of research, academic networks, programs of study, and international conferences. Yet the former often remain caricatures played in pervasive stereotypes for public consumption. We go through sort of superficial stuff that's expected, like the image of Canada being a Mountie in a red uniform, a lumberjack with a beard and a plaid shirt, and a toque. A little bit condescending, you think? Yet the former often remain characters playing to perversive stereotypes. Yes, and we use those stereotypes probably without thinking. Now, to the extent that a sociological focus exists, it emphasizes the historical, social, and cultural impact of fraternal orders. Relatively little attention has been paid to the contemporary meaning surrounding active participation constructed by members themselves. Dr. Kenny demonstrated empirically to reverse this focus, drawing upon analysis of qualitative interviews with 121 Masons in two Canadian provinces conducted between September 2006 and December 2007. He outlined six interactional elements that lead to a man's decision to become a Freemason. And as I said, predisposing factors in respondent's social background, the dramaturgical interplay between secrecy, mystery, and curiosity, organized and organizing encounters, attractive and attracting aspects, unattractive factors, hurdles to get over, and strategies employed to overcome such hurdles. While one or... Yes, and can we talk about these? And probably I can here. Because there's been some very, very unattractive things going on that, time and time again, we're talking to sort of doing one of these so-called non-recruiting drives, and I hear somebody talking about how it's astounding. As soon as you join, get more involved. Well, I'm thinking, these people don't even know what it is that they're joining, and you're talking about them having, you know, as if there's a, you're going to be sucked into this vortex of activity. And if anything could be less appealing, it's to be, is to have that done. Like, that's making broad, broad assumptions that are a barrier. And yet, time and time and time again, with a smile or a giggle or laughter, this is brought up. You can join, and there's lots of opportunity, and you can spend all this time. Well, you know, it's like somebody going in, taking a kid and selling him his first used car, you know, something that gives pretty good mileage, this isn't going to fall apart, and then saying, and when you come back, you can trade this up for a Ferrari. Whoa, how about one step at a time? Freemasonry needs to be, you know, at the very least, re-examine it. Stop that. What I'm talking about is not exactly a strategy to overcome such a barrier. How? So our insight isn't working, so apparently we have to be told. While one or another may be emphasized to a lesser or greater extent in specific cases, these six elements occurred with sufficient regularity to shed much-needed light on the significant question of attracting new members in the craft. So, Dr. Kenny is handing it to us. And does it work? There's a value. You know, I did take a lot of notes from his work. And no, I'm not going to share them with you right now. We have other things to do. So I apologize for that little going sideways on that. Excuse me. So when you caught your breath over that and said, where has this information been? Why, you know, why haven't we done this ourselves in our own lodges? Then we move into a bit of work on new Masonic records. This is by Charles Winston and Trevor Stewart. These fellows were just fantastic. They were lovely. Had a pace all their own, you know, a style of delivery all their own. Very well informed and charming. I could only say that in an old world, new world type of sense. In Scotland, they explained that there was an ongoing research project that produces a new form of Masonic historiographical record. Even with a bad throat, I couldn't get around that. There's a DVD, a video recordings of Freemasons being interviewed about their lives and their individual experience. Now, what these fellows are concerned about, lots of important information. Because, you know, in my mind, if you look at the minutes, a lot of lodges have minutes that don't reveal anything. So as an historic record, they're pretty useless. You know, we know six people showed up. It opened here, it closed here. Nothing about the content or the quality of what went on, or very, very little. Nothing impressionistic by the secretary. So what is that? How is that contributing? It's really not. And apart from the fact that it's organized into a binder. So these fellows were actually interviewing people on video and talking about pertinent Masonic topics. And then saying that, you know, the information, and a lot of it was impression of senior Masons, who gave a bit about their background and how they came into Freemasonry. And then it was obvious, as they showed some samples, how important this information would be to future generations of Freemasons. How vitally important and irreplaceable. So, it made me think that, you know, there was a time when we didn't write. And as a result, you know, we're still piecing together the artifacts. We're trying to piece together the events around the 15th century and the 14th century. And it wasn't an organized effort as it is today to try and record. So while a lot of lodges are sort of, you know, doing things, you know, as if it's tedious, not thinking about the historical context. There are other lodges that do bring color to, do bring three dimensions, four dimensions to the descriptions of meetings. And those will be valuable records in the future. I would only hope that every single lodge would want to be part of a larger discussion in the future, but perhaps not. Perhaps not. Perhaps there are lodges that just don't know or just don't care. Those are, I think, two of the biggest barriers to anything that we're going to do in Freemasonry. So thank you to Charles Winston and Trevor Stewart for bringing that forward. Then when you step back from that type of material, we get into esoteric Freemasonry and Shinshuko by Pauline Chakmayan of the United Kingdom. And they're talking about Shinshuko describing areas of spirituality in Japan referred to as the Japanese New Religions. And there were seven major areas that actually define Japanese religion: Shinto, Buddhism, Taoism, with a T, of course, Confucianism, Christianity, a folk religion, and these so-called new religions, according to historic events and cultural traditions. Many Japanese religious people will have the tendency to be active in more than one religious sphere rather than hold exclusive belief for one particular system. Some parallels can be drawn between this Japanese approach to spirituality and the esoteric aspect of speculative Freemasonry. Meaning, while speculative Freemasonry has a Judeo-Christian ritual base, one of these esoteric goals is to encourage an inner progress of the individual member's faith and morality by guiding them through a varied path of spiritual unfolding. Individual Freemasons may adhere to their personal faith, such as Christianity, Islam, or Judaism, but Freemasonry additionally strives to explore the truths found in several manifestations of spirituality through its hidden meanings, including classical or, quote, pagan systems like Egyptian religion. Japanese new religions have parallels to this new type of spiritual moral system, with the most significant similarly being between the two being both Japanese new religions and speculative Freemasonry, which began as enhancers of existing traditional forms of spirituality. Pauline explored how it had been increasingly common for Japanese new religions to eventually become new forms of traditional religion, much in the same manner as it has been common for Freemasonry to exist as an alternative to traditional spirituality when at one time it specifically served to merely enhance the Christian mystical experience. The paper explored how Japanese new religions coincidentally have many similar ideas and parallels in spiritual thought to the Western sociological phenomena of Freemasonry. Da da. Caught your breath yet? No time to waste. We check. Move on to the second plenary lecture. Man, I'm going to be at this for a couple of more shows. We're going to have to move on from this. I'm going to leave it off today. We're going to get into transformations, landscape garden to garden cemetery, a Masonic achievement. It is a little bit, you know, there's no fear of the topic, forming topics, is there? And then we're going to get into next time, No England is an Island, a Four Nations History of the 1813 Union. And for those of you who are, you know, conversant about chapter, capitular masonry and the Scottish Rite, we know that the resolution of the conflict or the disagreements between the ancients and moderns also had a very, very interesting bearing on the Royal Arch Masonry for a lot of very, very curious reasons. It's hard to ignore. And I'm wondering if that the uniqueness, you know, the, you know, Masonry has 3 degrees and the Royal Arch being the completion of the 3rd degree. That sort of, it's not vague, but it's curious wording that is sort of leaves, it's not nice and boxy, that so we can easily digest it. We actually have to think about it. Oh my goodness. May not have traveled well across the ocean. And maybe that explains, in my mind, the progress of the southern jurisdiction. Maybe because it was necessary that Freemasonry have a footprint in North America. Naively or not, I do think, I had this notion that we were moving possibly toward a universal Freemasonry. But when I listen to some of the work and research being done about earlier conferences that looked at unification, standardization, there are a lot of, it's not barriers, but a lot of factors that suggest there is a value to this community sense of Freemasonry, rather than one song sort of thinking. It's but we can and should talk about that more, because I thought, with this day of communication being upon us, we're going to we can convey ideas. It's simply the we need to rethink how we go about doing things. It's not to throw something out. It's rethinking and using contemporary terms and the contemporary tools that are available to us. The rightness or wrongness of this is not something that I can judge. And when I see somebody else doing that, I tend to be amazed. The rightness and wrongness of how we adjust will be known to us in hindsight. And likely, if we use principles and try and establish historical reference without being good historians, without being thorough scholars, we're going to be making a bit of a mess of things. We're going to be using very limited information, calling it and blending opinion with fact. I think that would probably explain a lot of the complications that we see. Why so compelling the question about helping other people? Well, here, let me just close off the show this day. Far too short, I find, and I hope you'd agree with me. I hope you found that interesting, that talk about the mention of, the whole idea of different papers and different kinds of thoughts and bring us up to date. Not the kind of conversation we normally have around Masonic education, where we look at of the apron. Generally, we don't go beyond a new way of thinking or new evidence. It tends to be fairly much standard, So I started off this program outline with a quote from William Shakespeare. And it says, "God has given you one face, and you make yourself another." I thought William hit the nail on the head with that one. It was interesting. And I have wondered out loud, and maybe it's the nature of my work, who amongst us reveals his true nature? Who? Is there any claimants to that? It'd be like saying, I'd have to understand my true nature in order to reveal it, wouldn't I? There are organizations that maintain secrecy to prevent knowledge of their existence. There are organizations that desire secrecy about their purpose. And then there are organizations that guard a secret. So if you're asking me, is Freemasonry a secret society? Yeah. We're a society the secret society that guards a secret. When asked the question, the accurate answer should probably have an explanation, just to be clear, to be sensitive but thorough. A few years ago, I realized there is a secret a Mason cannot communicate, even if he was to choose to do so. Despite the sincerity of our oaths over the years, we have initiated a man who did not fulfill the obligation, and he told all. He told everything to anybody, but he could never reveal the experience of initiation. I've spoken about this before. I had no idea there's a term for it, so I listened. I was doing some research on the work of the fellow from the Netherlands, a doctor from Netherlands, who's a foremost authority on a religious history of religions and fraternalism. And he talks to us about this type of secret, the secret of experience being the secret of allusion. That's A-L-L-U-S-I-O-N. Oh, how we muse over distractions. 1717. Freemasonry did not begin on the 24th of December, 1717. An organization, was it 23rd, I think, wasn't it? An organization began. And it wasn't what it is today. It wasn't secret. It didn't have a constitution. The membership was small. And it existed. Freemasonry existed in the city of London and Westminster. It seems so much is lost in the belief Freemasonry began in 1717, if that's what we say. It just seems like we lose a beautiful, beautiful under appreciation. Isn't that like saying art began in 1692 when Louis XIV ordered the creation of a gallery of antique sculpture at the Salon de Catalogne at the Louvre? Well, art didn't begin in 1692. The building, the Louvre, you know, the building was there before, but he ordered a gallery, Caryatides, at the Louvre for sculpture. Freemasonry is a gallery of ideas that include floors of arts and sciences where the language of philosophy is spoken. Rooms resplendent with themes of ethics and reality and symbolism, spirituality, truth and justice. It is what it is. We combat bigger issues, or we should. And we probably, just in the day, not every Freemason was like a Superman. Not every Freemason was a celebrity. Not every Freemason was a philosopher king. They were people. They were people that drew breath. We know that in the day it was important for men joining Freemasonry to have the time and the resources. In other words, it was thought that you needed to have a bit of both in order to be a Freemason. And today it's startling when you think about that. That's exactly the case. In order to do this, it does require commitment and time, and it does require resources. There's no question about that. Let me take you back a little bit in history, if you don't mind. A little bit of history about us as human beings. This is about some peaks and quarrels that we have with people today. The Black Death in 1348 and 49 led to a considerable shortage of laborers. In 1351, Edward III's Statute of Laborers tried to establish a maximum wage and a legal distinction between those able to work and those unwilling to work. And as he said, because a great part of the people, and especially of the workmen and servants, has now died in this pestilence, some, seeing the straits of the masters and the scarcity of servants, are not willing to serve unless they receive excessive wages. And others, rather than through labor to gain their living, prefer to beg in idleness. We have seen fit to ordain that every man or woman in our kingdom of England every man and woman of our kingdom of England, of whatever condition, whether bond or free, who is able-bodied and below the age of 60 years. Nice head, below the age of 60 years, be sought after to serve in a suitable service. and he shall take only the wages, liveries, meed, or salary, which, in the places where he sought to serve, were accustomed to be paid in the 20th year of our reign of England. If any man or woman, being thus sought after in service, will not do this, he shall be taken and sent to the next jail. And there he shall remain in strict custody until he shall find surety for serving in the aforesaid form. And because many sound beggars do refuse to labor, so long as they can live from begging alms, giving themselves up to idleness and sins, and at times to robbery and other crimes, let no one under the aforesaid pain of imprisonment presume, under color of piety or alms, to give anything to such as can carry well, very well labor, or to cherish them in their sloth, so that thus they may be compelled to labor for the necessities of life. That was the 14th century. Who's going to pay for these jails where we put everybody? Who's going to feed the people, and what outcome? To what end? So if we hear that kind of thinking, you know, what do? Whip the buggers into shape, throw them into jail. There you go. 14th century. You're in league with Edward III's Statute of Laborers. But in 1567, Thomas Harman, a Kentish gentleman, published a caveat for common curators, an account of the vagabonds and sturdy beggars of Elizabethan England. In his dedication to the Countess of Shrewsbury, he explained his purpose. As of ancient and long time, there have been and is now at this present many good, godly, profitable laws and acts made and set forth in this most noble and flourishing realm for the relief, succor, comfort, and sustenance of the poor, needy, impotent, and miserable creatures being and inhabiting in all parts of the same. So is their most wholesome statutes, ordinances, and necessary laws made, set forth, and published for the extreme punishment of all vagrants and sturdy vagabonds, as passes through and by all parts of this famous isle, most idly and wickedly. I thought it my bounden duty to acquaint your goodness with the abominable, wicked, and detestable behavior of all these rousy, ragged rabblement of rakeshals, that under pretense of great misery, diseases, and other innumerable calamities which they feign, though through great hypocrisy, do win and gain great alms in all places where they wander, to the utter deluding of the good givers, saying they're scam artists. In 1697, we're getting up to that, the thinking, the period of the men who came up with and started to develop ideas to form together. The ideas of the Renaissance and the Age of Enlightenment, and, you know, 1717 was an organizational epoch. 1697, following a rise in the parish poor rates, a property tax used to relieve poverty, John Locke, yes, the Scotsman, drew up a report for the Board of Trade on the proper methods for making the poor useful. The multiplying of the poor, he said, and the increase of the tax for their maintenance is so general an observation and complaint that it cannot be doubted of, nor has it only been since the last war that the evil has come upon us. It has been a growing burden on the kingdom these many years. Locke considered the evil was caused by the relaxation of discipline and the corruption of manners. He believed half of those receiving parish relief were able to earn their own livelihood and are neither wholly unable nor unwilling to work, but either through want of work being provided for them or their unskillfulness in working, do little that turns to public account. He recommended that working schools be set up. But King William III addressed Parliament on the subject of the poor rates in 1699, just a couple of years later. Again, this is coming up to a notable time in Masonic history. The increase of the poor is becoming a burden to the kingdom, and their loose and idle life does in some measure contribute to that deprivation of manners which is complained of, I fear, with much reason. Whether the ground of this evil be from defects in the laws or the execution of them deserves your consideration. as it is an indispensable duty that the poor who are not able to help themselves should be maintained, so I cannot but think it extremely desirable that such are as are able and willing should not want employment, and such are as are obstinate and unwilling should be compelled to work. Who decides? Who decides, Bill? But in 1817, a report in the Working Poor Laws was commissioned by a select committee in the House of Commons in Britain. The Hansard shows, in proposing the motion, Mr. John Cowan, the MP for Carlisle, stated that he did not attribute the evils which had arisen to the Act of Elizabeth I, the 1601 law that established the poor rates, but to those who administer relief under it in a way evidently foreign to the intention of the Act. That it was never designed to give a right of support to persons who, by the practice of frugality, sobriety, and industry, might have supported themselves. That it never was intended that men should anticipate parish relief as a means of support for themselves and their families, nor that they should be exonerated from all concern about their own well-being. That if the same system were continued, it would swallow up the whole revenue and industry of the country. How do you change expectations? These are the uncommonly difficult questions that we ask to do the right thing. Again, I ask your support, your help. What's the ethical thing to do? We want to be able to support people that can't and encourage people that may be slothsome, is that the word? But I hope the program has been informative and, again, entertaining. I certainly look forward to meeting and seeing you all. I hope you're doing well and that you're continuing to commit random acts of sonic kindness. It's not as foolish as you may think. You should be expecting more of the brethren around you because they expect more and should expect more of all of us as Masons. We do it right. We study, we think, we reason, and we do it with a sense of cordiality, good manners, and fraternalism. Until next week, thank you for joining me for another episode of Masonic Home Companion. I hope I've made a contribution. And take good care of yourselves in the meantime.
Thought we were loud, singing the song. Try to get back to something more simple than we have in my claim. 'Cause that's